Welcome to NEPR News Now, where we round up stories you shouldn't miss. I'm Heather Brandon. Climate change is expected to hit the Northeast pretty hard, affecting crops, ski resorts, and fisheries on the coast. In this episode, we bring you some of our latest New England climate change reports, from inland floods in New Hampshire to a Connecticut forest to a salt marsh north of Boston where there's an invasive plant that just won't quit.
We step into a muddy thicket of Phragmites with reeds towering over our heads. Mass Audubon sprayed the patch with herbicide in 2013.
And then all of a sudden, over the last 5 years, it's come back. So it's very resilient. You need to keep after it.
That story is just ahead on NEPR News Now. But first, the federal government recently released a lengthy climate assessment with a chapter focused on the Northeast. Our friends at WBUR put together a few New England takeaways you should know. First, climate change is affecting our health, bringing warmer temperatures that are actually rising faster in the Northeast than elsewhere in the continental U.S. That can mean more deaths from extreme heat, plus more troubles with ticks, asthma, and allergies. And warmer seasons will spell some trouble for some businesses, from fruit farmers to ski resorts. On the flip side, the changes could be a boon to some growers, and they'll see a longer growing season. And the report says fisheries will be affected by climate change as Northeast ocean temperatures are rising 3 times faster than the global average. That means there will be fewer of some species like northern shrimp, surf clams, and Atlantic cod. Other species will increase, like black sea bass. And lastly, the report says there's going to be more flooding everywhere in New England, with storm surges on the coast and occasional extremely heavy rainfall and floods inland. Jennifer Jacobs is a professor of civil and environmental engineering at the University of New Hampshire, and she's a lead author of a chapter in the federal climate change report. Here she talks with New Hampshire Public Radio's Rick Ganley about what's in store for the Granite State.
Let me ask you first about what your work says about what is happening right here in New Hampshire right now. How is our state's infrastructure affected by climate change already?
Well, probably the biggest effects that we see in New Hampshire along the New Hampshire seacoast, the rising seas and some of these high tide floods. We saw them a lot last winter, and we're anticipating seeing them quite a bit in the future.
We have talked a lot about what's happening right along the seacoast with that sea level rise, but I don't know if people really think too much about the heavier rainfall and the flooding that's happening, you know, more inland with roads and, you know, infrastructure. What about those rural areas, say, in the northern and western parts of the state?
Well, those areas are really vulnerable. What we've been finding with the changing climate is that we have more precipitation happening overall. This fall was a great example, and more precipitation happening in these heavy storms. And so we saw an example a few years back from Hurricane Irene, where we just had devastating floods throughout the area, but we're routinely seeing pop-up floods throughout the region that are either putting roads underwater or taking out roads and culverts and making areas inaccessible. So this is something that's certainly happening throughout the state.
And again, you can quantify this over the last several years. You've seen more heavier rain events.
We can quantify this over the last 30 years. We're seeing an upward trend. And what the Climate Science Special Report said was that this area, the Northeast area, is the area that's seeing the largest changes in rainfall.
And you mentioned Hurricane Irene, which, you know, came through. And, of course, I'm thinking of parts of, especially in parts of the North Country, but into Vermont particularly. There's still areas in Vermont that have yet to fully recover from where they were several years before that. Isn't that true?
Absolutely. And that was one of our key messages in this in the transportation chapter, is talking about not just how the transportation is affected, but how communities are affected. And one of the things that we found, not just in New Hampshire, but across the nation, is that small communities don't have the capability to be able to recover from these events like a large metropolitan area would be able to. And so it takes years, sometimes even longer than that, to be able to put Humpty Dumpty back together again after these devastating floods.
And do you see towns and cities, especially along the seacoast, I imagine, but do you see the towns and cities responding to this in their planning and looking ahead and being forward-thinking?
Absolutely. All the seacoast communities are aware of what the challenges are. Many of them are putting in different regulations. They're including sea level rise in their planning process. So it's a time where there's a lot of movement in our coastal region to really being able to handle this. And I would say New Hampshire is really a leader in this area. The community and the strength, even though we've got a relatively small seacoast, is really a shining star in our nation.
you know, the last year or 2 years, seeing more of these heavy rainfall events, seeing more instances of coastal flooding, do you see people's attitude changing?
I do see people's attitude changing, and I think that's for the general public. And one of the things that's really interesting that's come out fairly recently is a number of these Zillow house surveys, where what they're finding is that the increases in value for residential properties is not increasing as fast in coastal areas that are vulnerable to sea level rise as compared to those houses that are at a higher elevation. So people are starting to recognize this, and they're voting with their pocketbook.
Well, the report shows that New Hampshire might be a bit better off in some instances from other parts of the country, but, you know, a lot of our infrastructure, it's old, it's built along, you know, rivers, it's rooted in our history of mill towns. I'm wondering how some, you know, heavy rain events and more heavy rain events could contribute to water pollution issues or other issues on infrastructure.
So we didn't really tackle the water quality issues, but what we do know is that anytime a road washes out, it puts debris into the river, and in order to be able to repair those bridges or repair those roads, we oftentimes try to put construction vehicles into the riverbed, and that's really can potentially cause damage to those rivers or to the ecosystems in those rivers. And so I think as we start seeing these events more and more, we start getting smarter about how do we get those barricades off the road as fast as possible, but also how do we make certain that we protect our rivers and our ecosystems.
Well, you know, lastly, I want to ask you, are you hopeful, seeing how towns and cities are planning ahead? Do you feel that we can handle the effects of climate change going forward?
I'm cautiously optimistic. The New Hampshire effort that's been put forward to date is really forward-thinking. We've got a great team of people that are working and are very aware of what the challenges are. That said, these challenges are not going to be easy to address. As we're talking about sea level rise by the end of the century on the order of 6.5 feet to 8 feet. And in some cases, we can't engineer ourselves out of that. Across the country, there's already communities, coastal communities, that are in the process of retreating from the ocean. And so these are not engineering questions. These are community questions, and these are planning questions that are going to be really difficult to handle.
That was Rick Ganley from New Hampshire Public Radio talking with Jennifer Jacobs, a professor at the University of New Hampshire, who was a lead author of a chapter in the recent federal climate assessment. Find more details on that and a link to the report at nepr.net. There's no single kind of scientist working on climate change. As Jacobs just pointed out, there are many different kinds of experts working on solutions, and they're coming up with new questions and problems to solve. That's what's been happening in Connecticut, where scientists are looking at how to measure trees' storage of carbon. It's an important question because some polluters, depending on local laws, are able to offset their own carbon emissions by purchasing what are known as carbon credits. But we need good measurement tools to be sure those offsets make sense. Connecticut Public Radio's Patrick Scahill reports.
When Bob Mara goes into the woods, he takes a tool with him, a hammer, his magic sonic hammer.
It's not called a magic sonic hammer. It's called the sonic hammer, but I call it the magic sonic hammer just because it looks kind of cool.
Mara is a biologist with the Connecticut Agricultural Experiment Station. And while the hammer isn't magical, it's about to do something pretty cool. Help us look inside a tree. To do that, Mara hammers nails into the trunk of a sugar maple in northwest Connecticut, girdling the tree with sensors. Then he circles, tapping on each nail. Each tap is recorded by a very polite computer.
Please, measurements at this spot have been recorded.
Mara's recording sound waves, measuring how fast sound travels from the nail he hits to all the other nails around the tree. It's called sonic tomography. Think of it like a CAT scan for trees, a way to peer inside a trunk without drilling to see if a tree is rotting or solid wood.
The denser the wood, the faster the sound waves.
Dense wood is really good at storing carbon, but if a tree is less dense inside, that could indicate decay, and also that the tree might not be as good at storing carbon as we think. Using a grant from the National Science Foundation, Mara tested his tomography idea, scanning around 70 trees in northwest Connecticut. He found dozens were rotting inside, even ones that on the outside looked good.
What's going on inside of these trees, it's kind of hidden to us for the most part. Trees that otherwise look to be perfectly fine and you would have no reason to think otherwise can have internal decay taking place.
Mara says that's an important consideration, especially when it comes to carbon storage or sequestration.
If we're going to look to forests as a way to sequester carbon, we should develop much more accurate estimates of how much carbon is actually sequestered.
Because, well, there are whole markets based on this, like in California. Its aggressive pollution regulations have fostered an expansive cap-and-trade program. California polluters can offset emissions by buying up carbon credits, and landowners across America can profit by proving their forest is really good at storing atmospheric carbon. Rajinder Sahota is with the California Air Resources Board, which oversees the program. She explains the process.
What you do is you have a measurement at the beginning of that time period that says, here's how much is in my forest.
Then, through yearly audits, landowners prove their land, over time, can store carbon in a way that's better than business as usual.
Here's how my forest looks relative to what is the common amount of stored carbon, and here's how much, if I undertake some activities, I can increase that carbon storage in my forest.
But measuring all that? Well, here's where it gets tricky.
You look at any tree, especially a hardwood tree, and look at its shape. I mean, that's really complex.
Christopher Woodall is a researcher with the U.S. Forest Service. His equations are used by California to calculate stored carbon.
You estimate the volume, and then you got to figure out the biomass within that volume, and then turn that into an estimate of carbon.
To do that, foresters don't go out and look at every tree. Instead, they sample, measuring a variety of trees and plugging those numbers into a complex model. But forestry science is evolving. Woodall has since published work saying the equations need to be improved, in part because new technologies are making biomass estimates more efficient and precise.
I think we're not too far away from not necessarily sampling trees in the U.S., but actually having a true census. Eventually, with a combination of satellites and with drones and laser scanning, we're headed to the point where we might be able to know something about every tree in the U.S.
He says that could happen soon or in 50 years. But for now, scientists are taking baby steps, trying to assess the role of forests in climate change, because, as Woodall says, it's too important to ignore. For the New England News Collaborative, I'm Patrick Scahill in Hartford.
One more note on trees and climate change. There's a report out from the journal Global Change Biology that says northeastern sugar maple trees are projected to grow about 40% slower in New England. That's because warmer temperatures in the region mean shrinking snowpack, and maple trees need that deep snow to insulate their shallow roots. So not only is the maple syrup industry affected, but so is the carbon storage our forests help to manage. Nationwide, that's between 5 and 30% of carbon dioxide emissions. For more on sugar maples, head over to NEPR.net. Now we turn to an invasive plant at the top of Massachusetts ecologists' most wanted list. It's a tall, bushy-topped reed called Phragmites. State, federal, and private groups spend tens of thousands of dollars each year trying to control it, but emerging research shows that Phragmites may play a more complicated role in climate change than previously realized. WBUR's Barbara Moran has the story.
Oh, this is serious Phragmites.
This is a story about a bad guy who might have a shot at redemption. Its name is Phragmites australis, an invasive plant commonly known as the common reed, or as some call it, the all-too-common reed.
Is that Phragmites up there?
Everything here is Phragmites along here, and there's some on that side. There's always a lot of Phragmites.
Robert Buxbaum, an ecologist with Mass Audubon, has been fighting Phragmites for decades. One battlefield is the Rough Meadows Wildlife Sanctuary in Rowley, part of the largest salt marsh in New England. We head in.
I don't think it'll be too wet for you.
Well, let's do it.
Yeah.
The plant is a familiar sight in New England marshes, where it typically stands about 13 feet tall. It crowds out native plants, destroys habitats, and clogs streams. The state, Mass Audubon, and the National Park Service all have programs to combat it, but it's remarkably hard to kill. One tactic? Drown it in salt water. Another? Crack open its hollow stem and drip poison down its neck.
So we treated the Phragmites, and you can see it was gone. It looked great.
We step into a muddy thicket of Phragmites with reeds towering over our heads. Mass Audubon sprayed the patch with herbicide in 2013.
And then all of a sudden, over the last 5 years, it's come back. So it's very resilient. You need to keep after it.
Phragmites is a formidable foe because of its tall plants, dense stands, and deep roots. But these same traits can offer surprising benefits for climate change. Right now, there's too much carbon dioxide in the air. We need to pull it out and put it somewhere. Phragmites can store a lot of carbon in the soil when it dies, even more than native plants, according to a recent study. And there's another plus. Its dense growth can help build up marshes against sea level rise. So while many scientists remain dead set against the common reed, some are looking at this old enemy in a new way.
Yeah, we try to knock it back every once in a while, but it takes a lot of time and effort and money. And
Nancy Powell is a biologist at the Parker River National Wildlife Refuge on Plum Island. She was one of about 30 or 40 marsh experts who gathered at the Plum Island Ecological Research Site last month to drink beer, eat pizza, and talk about wetlands. And some of these conversations now include Phragmites' role in climate change.
You know, because it's such a robust grower, it does make a lot of biomass, and some of that gets turned into peat. It's sequestering, it's taking carbon out of the air and putting in the roots.
Pau says the trade-offs are complicated. Phragmites gives off methane, a potent greenhouse gas, and the plant only stores carbon permanently when it decomposes into peat, and the peat is left alone. Pau says that keeping marshes healthy and diverse is her priority, for now anyway. So she'll keep on fighting or treating frag, as she calls it, where she can. But other ecologists may decide differently.
In the mid-Atlantic, where they are losing a lot of the marshes really quickly, there is discussions about whether or not they should be treating frag, because it is one of the few plants that is keeping up with sea level rise. And they had a very aggressive treatment plan down there.
No scientist I spoke to could imagine actually planting Phragmites. But where the invader has already won or has overtaken a mudflat or brownfield, some think maybe they should just leave it alone. Smithsonian ecologist Ian Davidson, who wrote a recent paper on carbon storage in invasive plants, says context matters.
So there's a fairly universal agreement that we should try and reduce and prevent invasions as much as we can. But there's also the world that we have right now where they already are in certain systems. You know, this is one factor that should be considered among many.
Back on the marsh, Mass Audubon's Buxbaum said he bears the invader no ill will, but he doesn't want to use it to fight climate change.
You know, to me, there's other ways to handle it. You know, should we be depending on an invasive species which causes a degradation of the habitat to make up for our foibles of emitting too much carbon into the atmosphere? Is that the right approach to take, or should we be doing something to reduce our carbon?
But reducing our carbon footprint quickly enough to avoid the worst consequences of climate change won't be easy. And it may mean accepting some of our old enemies. For the New England News Collaborative, I'm Barbara Moran.
Thanks for joining us. For much more news from New England Public Radio, head on over to NEPR.net. We also have a great selection of podcasts to choose from, including Beacon Hill and Five, where host Carrie Healy talks to State House reporter Matt Murphy for a quick look at the week ahead in politics and government in Massachusetts. And remember, New England Public Radio is a listener-supported public media company, so all of this is made possible by contributions from you and other members of our community. Thanks so much for listening. Until next time.